Welcome to the Exceptional Sales Leader Podcast with Darren Mitchell. If you're a sales leader looking to take your leadership to a whole new level, then this is the podcast for you. We'll be exploring tips, techniques, and strategies to help you take your leadership to the exceptional level and allow you to enjoy more money, more meaning, and better sales results. Welcome back to the Exceptional Sales Leader Podcast. This is Darren Mitchell on a beautiful Friday. It's actually not a beautiful Friday. It is a Friday. At least the birds are chirping. There's no wind. There's actually no sun, but absolute pleasure to have Sam Schaefer on the call today. Sam, welcome, mate. And we've just been talking for about 20 minutes, reminiscing on a few things and working out that we've got a lot more in common than we thought we might have.
Yeah. It's a small world coming. No, I don't. As I said, I don't meet too many people that come from Gisborne and that side of town, especially in the sales and marketing world. I'm excited to dig into some interesting topics today.
Love it, mate. Gisborne. For those of you listening, no matter where you happen to be in the world, Gisborne is one of the most picturesque places in the Macedon Ranges. It's a beautiful place. We're filled with beautiful people. And you know what, Sam? They do let people in who have a sales and marketing background. So it's amazing about that. They obviously let all people come in.
Yeah, all riffraff and welcome in Gisborne.
Awesome. So I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation. We've been connected a little while now on LinkedIn and we've got a mutual connection, Graham Hawkins, and a shout out to Graham. If he happens to be listening to this, you're a great man. But I'm really impressed with some of the work that you do, particularly in the space. And we talked earlier about a lot of it right now is B2C. But I think the approach that you take around sales and marketing has so much applicability for people in business to business as well. And whether that be a business person who's running their own organization or business people in sales teams looking to, I guess, penetrate the market or provide more value to the marketplace. So this is going to be a great conversation. I don't know what sort of question I'm going to ask you, but I'm sure they're going to be fantastic as we move forward. You are the founder of Schaefer's, and I love this because it's fractional RevOps. And love to know, before we jump into some cool topics, or hopefully what will be cool topics, love to know a little bit of background on you for the listeners' benefit, and specifically what led you to do the work that you did or that you do today, because I know there's a bit of a sales background there and revenue ops and so forth. But what's your background and what sort of led you to do what you do today?
Yeah. So I kind of came up on the back street of sales and primarily in actually B2B. So even though now majority of the clients I'm working with are B2C, my main background and obviously working life has been in the B2B space. It's just sometimes we'll say B2B operators, their minds are a little more difficult to change than some of the B2C operators. So it was an easier path to market initially. But when I say the backstreet of sales, like primarily early on in the startup world. So initially started as a PT myself probably 2012 or so, 2013, when I was 18, 19. And built that from scratch, lived in America for a year and did college over there whilst playing soccer, and built out a couple of boot camps over there to pay my way. So that was kind of my early exposure to sales in a sense, not that I like considered it sales. I was just walking the streets, handing pamphlets out to people going, hey, do you want to come to a free workout, and trying to hook them in that way. So no, had no coaching, had no idea really what I was doing. I just thought that if I gave people a free workout, then they would probably come back for more and want to pay if they enjoyed it. So got back to Australia, carried on with the PT world for a little bit. And then my first opportunity in sales came up. I saw an advertisement for a role at a company called Winning International. It was a digital marketing agency here in Melbourne. Relatively newish startup, probably like 4 years into their game. And the advertisement said 300K to 400K OTE. I had no idea what OTE meant at the time, but I was like, oh, I want to make 300K to 400K. That'd be nice. It's more than I'm making as a PT. So applied, ended up getting the role initially as an appointment setter. So setting obviously the appointments for the other sellers. And my initial KPI set was, now looking back, pretty ridiculous, but I managed to make it work. So the targets I had to hit were to qualify for commissions, which obviously is a sell. The majority of your income comes from commissions. I had to hit 50 bookings per week with an 80% minimum show-up rate for those bookings for the sales team. Which anyone that's done that sort of a role would know that 50 bookings a week is pretty intense. And I was there. I think I'd get to the office at about 7 a.m., have a quick shower because I'd go to the gym before the office. And then we'd have our morning meeting at 8, and I'd start dialing from 8:30, and most of the time wouldn't leave till 7, 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, because I needed to hit 10 plus bookings a day. But managed to do it. Got the show rate as well. So that really taught me not only the harder side of sales, but some tips and tricks around, in getting people to show up, and the right people to show up. But then when I went into the sales side, so I was in there for 3 months before getting promoted. As I got promoted over the course of the next month, everyone else quit. So at one point it was just me as the only seller, in the business, which was a fun and intense time. So I had to do the whole cycle. So the job I was doing previously of setting my own appointments, I had to do that side, plus now do the closing side. But this was my first sort of hint between the synergy of marketing and sales, because not that I was amazing or 100 times better than the other sellers previously, but I was hitting higher numbers than they were from a conversion rate perspective, like on an individual level. Obviously, I didn't outsell the whole team, but on an individual level, my conversion rates were way higher. I hit more records in that time when I was doing the full cycle, when they were just doing the end of it. And it wasn't because, again, not because I was so much better, but I had the pick of the leads in the sense. So when I was going through the leads, if someone was going to be a time waster or they weren't at the stage of like that I thought they would progress quickly through the pipeline, I just wouldn't book them in. So I would just look for the best people, book them in, and hit my numbers. And then go to the next year, the sales team, he hired a new sales team, like six people all at once, put me in charge because I was I just kind of got thrown under the bus there and was like, oh, well,
The
you're the
poison
only one
chalice.
most experienced, so you're in charge. So I had to coach this team, et cetera. But that was where I saw that cycle of low intent lead gen break again, because as soon as they brought six more in, obviously they increased the marketing budget, flood more leads into the team. Now everyone's screamed because our KPI from an input perspective was 10 discovery calls, no, 15 discovery calls a week, 10 pitches a week. So now everyone was scrambling to hit those numbers. So they were just booking in. Whereas I could be picky before, I couldn't be picky now because I just needed to
Get
hit
the
my
number.
numbers. So my conversion rates dropped, everyone else's conversion rates dropped, and where I hit 17 sales, I think, in the month of December the previous year. I think the team as a whole only hit around 25, 26 sales in the January, and then it was sort of similar for February and March. So they've added six salaries, more commissions, more ad spend, just for like an incremental gain in revenue. And that was like, oh, I didn't get it at the time, but something was broken at that stage. And then from there, I went to, I guess you could call it like freelance sales, commission only sales, with a company or a fitness influencer, Jay Piggin. And we, yeah, we blew that business up. We went from when I joined, it was just shy of a mil annual revenue. So they were around sort of like 850K. And by the time I left and Jay sold the business, we cleared 10 mil in annual revenue. So we're averaging about 200 to 250K a week worth of contracts. It's me as the only seller. And that was because I could see the, and that again highlighted the difference between the low intent lead gen model at the previous company to the high intent lead gen model at this company and the synergies between marketing and sales. Then went and started my own company. I won't go down that trail because that's a long story, but got a, learned the hard life of business in terms of signing the wrong contracts, got kind of stabbed in the back by a business partner at the time, and then went into the agency world for a little bit again just to get back on my feet. And that was where I started inadvertently doing RevOps in those companies, and started looking for RevOps roles because I heard about the sort of function from the Americans and what they were doing over there. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting to me because I knew how to do marketing. I'd run ad campaigns. So when I was in the agencies, I was running ad campaigns and obviously running them for my own business. And then so I knew that synergy between marketing and sales, and it fell under the umbrella of RevOps, but no one in Australia was doing RevOps. Like I looked all the time for roles in RevOps and was like, oh, is anyone kind of hiring for this? Couldn't find any. So I just thought, I'll just create it myself and pitch it to companies instead. And that's what I did.
Nice. Now, for those that mate, there's so much in there I want to unpack. And we probably need a whole week to go through it all. But
Yeah, long
for
story.
people, yeah, no, it's a great story. And a lot of things that I've seen this in the posts you put on LinkedIn. And if you listen to this and you haven't connected and at least followed Sam, please do. And we'll get Sam to share some details of how to do that towards the end of today. But for people listening to this, first and foremost, because RevOps for some people might be a foreign concept, and it's so if you would explain to somebody, Sam, what's RevOps? What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's essentially enabling cross-department collaboration to accelerate pipeline and revenue growth. Like everyone's got their own little spin on it, in terms of definitions, but that's what how I see it. Some people see it as just like the technology side of like playing in the CRM and everything, but in my view, and from what I've gathered and learned from mentors over in America, it's the glue between marketing, sales, and CS. So because oftentimes in companies, you'll find they're quite siloed. And then you get that misalignment where marketing are just trying to drive as many leads as possible. They don't talk to sales. Sales get really annoyed at marketing because they're like, oh, these leads are all trash. We'll just go find our own leads. And then sales, because they need to hit numbers, end up trying to sell anyone and everyone, which then annoys CS because they're like, stop selling these people because they keep churning and you're making our numbers look bad. And then everyone's kind of against each other, whereas RevOps ties all of them together through that cross-department collaboration.
So we could almost describe it as revenue operations, where you've got the operational part of the business that might be a little bit of the post sales, then you've got the revenue generation model as well. So putting those together, you provide an overarching view of the business and hopefully have better control.
Yeah, it's kind of like a bird's eye view of the go-to-market method of the business, like the entire revenue engine. And it's a function that I think a lot of businesses sorely miss. And as you said, it's one that not too many businesses are embracing or understanding at the moment. So that's a challenge that I've faced with trying to bring that to market in terms of that education gap. So a lot of the times with customers or clients that I currently work with, I'll end up starting in the marketing side. So I'll start developing their marketing campaigns and running their paid advertising. And then they'll see that the flow on effect for that, there's obviously bottlenecks in sales. And I'm like, oh, well, we should do this on sales. And then I gradually upsell them into the full go-to-market cycle because that lack of understanding is just there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the other thing, based on as you were talking about that around lead gen, you made reference to low intent versus high intent. So for
Yeah.
people listening to that, how would you describe the difference?
So low intent lead gen models are essentially models where you're capturing someone's details that has signaled no interest to buy. Most common model being like download an ebook, download a white paper, etc. And then you send that contact to sales and get sales to chase them around and basically be like, oh, hey, we saw you downloaded our ebook about this. Is that something you're looking to solve? I don't know. And that model can work. Like I've got friends who run that model at a low level. But the issue is, like I experienced in that first company that I was at, when I was the only seller and I was able to be picky, and even though we had lots of leads, so it was a lot of work for me to do to chew through them all, I was able to be picky and be, I guess, more selective with who entered my pipeline. So my pipeline was way more efficient. But as soon as that team expanded, and that's the gripe I have with a lot of marketers is they kind of have this mentality of, oh, if we spend 10 grand and it made 100. If we spend 100, we'll make 1 million. And if we spend 1 million, we'll make 10 million. But obviously, if anyone has an understanding of the buyer's pyramid principle and any, I guess, sense of how market dynamics work, markets aren't fractal in that just because it works at this pocket doesn't mean it's going to work at that pocket because you get different stages of awareness, sophistication, etc. So as you push that low intent lead gen model to the extremes of that market, you're obviously pushing out of that ready to buy cycle of buyers and into people that just aren't a right fit. And then you're flooding that to sales. It's clogging up their pipeline. They're under pressure to hit targets, et cetera, versus a high intent lead gen model, which is, and that's just kind of a made up term that I made on the spot then, but it's essentially you'll have like your models to generate this, that, or if we use the buyer's pyramid as the example, obviously these numbers are arbitrary, but the buyer's pyramid suggests that at any time, 3% of buyers are actively in market, 7% are actively looking for solutions but haven't settled on one yet. So you're trying to capture that top 3%, but then you've got an ecosystem developed to educate people outside of that that keeps them away from sales. So they're not occupying sales time until they move up into that top, 3 to 10% when they're actually serious about talking about a solution.
Yeah, love it. Because as you were talking about that, I'm thinking, people listening to this are probably, and particularly salespeople, they're probably thinking, geez, if only marketing could give me better leads, right? The last 4 or 5 calls I've been on, they've just been tire kickers. So where do I find these 3% people? So we just have to understand that. And look, sales is a numbers game, and I don't like referring to that because I think it can be better than that, but you do have to go through the numbers, but it comes down to the qualification process. So the other thing I wanted to ask you is going back to winning international and your first gig, and correct me if I'm wrong, you probably didn't realize anything different because you just looked at KPIs and I've got to make 50 bookings, I've got to have an 80% show up rate. Let's just get to work.
Pretty
So
much.
do you look back on that now and say, you know what, it was great that I didn't know what I didn't know. And knowing what you know now, if you had your time over again, would you do something different in that particular role that may have led you down, I don't know, not so much a different path, but may have led you to maybe make some different decisions?
I think that role was kind of perfect for me at the time where I was at. But it wasn't until I went into the agency world and started speaking to the likes of Graham, and started learning from like Chris Walker over in the States, and some of these more advanced minds, because I always knew there was something wrong, but I just couldn't quite articulate or put my finger on it. But then when, say, Graham or Chris or some of these other operators that I follow actually put it into words, I was like, light bulb. So back in that old role, at the time, it served its purpose. But looking back, there were times when I booked people in that I shouldn't book in because I just had to hit my numbers. I had to hit my 50, I hit to, had to hit my 80%. So if I had to book someone in that was probably going to waste the salesperson's time, but I need to hit my 50 so I get paid anyway, so I'm just going to do it. My incentive structure is actually misaligned to revenue and business growth. And that's typically what I see now and learned more so in the agency world, because in that world, I was used to just being flooded with leads regardless of level of intent. So I could just always hammer through calls, had some sort of lead in, et cetera. But in the agency world, funnily enough, a lot of agencies aren't that great at their own marketing. And so I ended up having to source a lot of my own pipeline. So I was like, well, rather than waste my time going through this list of very unqualified, like, for example, there'd be l lists 100 plus long that people have just started Shopify stores and stuff like nowhere near were able to work with an agency. So I was like, well, don't bother giving me them. I'll just go source my own stuff because it's going to be a more valuable use of my time. And back then, as you said, it was just a numbers game. I just had to push the numbers through, hit my KPIs. But now that I've sort of gone through my journey and I can see the connection points, because that business, winning international, ended up going into liquidation and going out of business, because the incentive structure across the whole business was based around everyone just trying to hit their own individual goals versus team goals. So my incentive was just to get as many bookings as I could. That then led it to sales. They would end up pitching people that they probably shouldn't be pitching and saying things they probably shouldn't say to get sales across because they want commissions. Then they go to customer success and have a huge churn rate, lots of dissatisfied customers. And what ended up undoing that business is someone that they actually hired in that second lot of sales team that I was in kind of took it upon themselves to, we'll say, ruin the business, but found a legal loophole for the clients because he felt bad that a lot of these clients weren't getting the service that they were being promised, or weren't getting the results they were being promised. So he showed these clients how they could get their money back. They all went and claimed their money back and drove the business out of business. Now, it's not to say that the business was bad in the sense that when the client was right, the business over-delivered. Like they would get great results. The business so it was a they operated in sort of the B2C world as well, in terms of providing digital leads, et cetera, to B2C operators. When the business was right, it grew. No question. Like the majority of the clients that I brought on during that period when I was by myself, like 90%+ success rate. But when it expanded, the success rate dropped dramatically. And that eventually just led to a lot of dissatisfied customers, because again, the incentive model from marketing, starting all the way out there, was how many leads did you get this week? Oh, you got 1,000 leads. Good work, marketing. Sales, how many sales did you make? Good work, sales. Customer success, how many successful clients? Oh, only 5%. What's going on? So the whole thing was just misaligned.
And fragmented and siloed. And as I've heard you talk a lot on the workshops and stuff that you've sent through to me is marketing will blame sales for not converting. Sales will blame marketing for not giving them decent leads. And at the end of the day, the business, but more importantly, the customer ends up paying the price because you have discontent and you can't have salespeople just smiling and dialing, hoping that they're going to be able to convert, just going through numbers. Because I say to people all the time, particularly in business to business sales, it's the impressions you create and it's the seeds you continue to plant that will eventually create the harvest. So you've got to be able to be consciously aware of what the impression is you want to create every single time you're in connection with somebody.
Definitely. And you see this a lot with we'll say boom and bust companies where they'll be like, we're the fastest growing in this, or we've reached seven figures in 6 months or whatever, whatever. And then 3 years later they're gone. Because they just push for the revenue. They don't care how efficient the revenue growth is. Oh, well, if it costs us $1,000 to acquire a customer, we'll just pass that cost on to the customer. So they charge way more for their services than are necessary. The cost gets thrown to the customers. The customers get unsatisfied, and then that word spreads and spreads and spreads and spreads. And even though they're growing, 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 eventually the market catches up to them, whether it's 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later. Like in my time, I think in my time, I say a short period of time. Obviously, I haven't been in the game for, say, as long as yourself or Graham, but I've seen probably three or four companies that have gone through that boom bust cycle. And it's purely because they're just so focused on that growth at all costs mentality that they end up burning customers and burning team members along that journey.
And the thing they probably don't recognize at the time or maybe choose to ignore at the time is that also creates an impression not only on the marketplace that they operate in, the customers they burn, but also the people within the business who they burn that can go and can spread like wildfire in terms of the marketplace and other organizations. And it is it when I see boom and bust type situations, it doesn't surprise me because there's always something at the core of that. And it's typically going to be coming back to things like culture, how we treat our internal people, what sort of process we have in place, and then how do we deal with our customers, and do we truly put the customer at the front of everything we do?
And when it comes to from a cultural perspective as well, like just being able to acknowledge logic, I think, is something that misses in a lot of businesses. And I get it from, like, obviously now being a or having a previous business, but being a founder and having to grow revenue, I know there's a lot of pressure on, especially if it's a founder-led business and the founder's still growing the business, a lot of pressure to get numbers in, get cash in the door because you've got bills to pay, you've got your family to feed. Like it's hard. It's not easy. And I think that's something a lot of and myself included, employees sometimes forget and don't quite know or acknowledge. Because I remember in that first job, I was again, I was like 24 at the time or 25, so a kid and naive. But I'd make a sale and it'd be like a 20K, 25K sale or something. I'm like, oh, I just made Ryan was the CEO. I just made Ryan 20 grand and I'm only getting paid $600 out of this. What the hell? but
That was not
so
fair about that. What's going on?
yeah, like this seems a bit unequated. So naivety from that sense, but then there's the side of it where Gary Vee says this quite well. He says no one should care about your business as much as you. Like if you put the expectation for your staff to care as much about your business as you're setting yourself up for failure. And there was one time I had a sales manager in sort of that second stint in the agency world. When I first went to the agency, I set in my first rec month, I set like a first month record hitting six figures in contracted value, which no one had ever done in their first month. Second month, I doubled that and came second globally in the team. And then the third month, I had a bit of a slower month. Still hit target, but not like a barnstormer like the first two. And then he came and threatened to like, oh, well, if you don't pick up your game, we're going to shut off leads. And I'm like, hold on. Actually, with what I was given, performed quite well. So to prove my point, I went into the CRM and did a bit of RevOps work. Not that I knew it was RevOps at the time, but broke down my entire pipeline from qualified, unqualified, meetings booked, et cetera, and showed that out of all the leads that were distributed to me, because that was part of his argument, we've given you the most leads because of your first 2 months and you haven't converted, whatever. I said, here's the list. 92% of these leads were deemed unqualified, as in their budget was well below what we can service. So you can go validate that yourself, go check the business. If you want to call them all, go for it. I said, but out of what was actually qualified, I converted 64% of them. So my qualification, my conversion rate was still exceptionally high, and then I still had some in pipeline. So my first week of the following month, I knocked through like nearly 70K worth of deals because of the flow on. So even though the monthly target, it was like I hit the monthly target, but it wasn't like a barnstormer. The month was still like from a performance perspective, pretty good. But I'm just not being given the opportunities. I'm having to go and, hunt for my own opportunities on LinkedIn and stuff. And his response was, you're just not pitching enough, mate. You need to pitch more. And I'm like, no. Like, and that was when I was like, you just lost all respect, man, because I know you don't get it.
That is a classic example of a person being, and I say this to people all the time, often, unfortunately. And particularly in organizations, B2B type organizations, they get promoted to a higher level of incompetence. And often they get promoted there because they've been a great salesperson or they've been a great individual contributor of some role. And they think, oh, mate, Sam, you're an absolute superstar. If we put the management hat on for you, you'll be able to then, it's almost like by osmosis, get
Everyone
your
else
team
becomes
to
good.
be firing up and be as successful as you. Not remembering that, mate, there's a completely different set of skill sets required to run a team. So, for sales manager, and this is why I'm standing here. For those who can't see the video because it's all obviously an audio podcast, but I'm sitting here with my hand over my head, thinking, my God, that is the worst thing to do. What that manager should have been doing is saying, mate, you've set a record first month ever. You've doubled in the second month. Okay, it's down third month, but you still made your sales. My goodness, how do I bottle you up and how do I get my other salespeople to do what you do? Because you've got something that these guys don't. Instead of,
That was my
that's
like, not
what
to
they
toot
want.
my own horn, but like that would have been if I was managing me at the time, and you got to know your team as well. Like my personality is some people do get fired up by that stuff. Like when someone says, "Hey, you're doing shit," and I'm like, "Oh, well, I'll show you," and they go work harder. But that's not my personality. Like if you criticize, especially if it's not justified, I'm just gonna switch off. Because you can't explain to me like, and it makes me a bit of a pain in the ass to work with at times. Because if you can't explain to me the logical reason why you're telling me to do what you're telling me to do, then I'm probably not gonna do it. Especially if I think I know better, even if I might not, but you can't explain to me why I should do it. And I think a lot of salespeople are like that, besides when they're kind of younger. And I say that to a lot of my clients with especially ones that are in that sort of startup phase, is a lot of my clients are sort of between that 750 to 1.5 level in revenue. So really early stage startups, like they don't want to hire someone like me as a sales rep, because I'll be a pain in the ass, because I'll question everything. So they just need someone that's young, dumb, hungry, that'll listen to what they have to say, even if it's not perfect. Because if you get a seasoned professional that can see all the faults and the holes, they're either gonna request you fix them or they're gonna leave. So it's yeah, it's a difficult balancing act.
Well, it can be, but I think that's what makes you unique, right? So if I was a sales leader with somebody like you, I would know not to throw the stick at you. I'd be looking at how do I tap into this person's intellect, because you're obviously a deep thinker and you're very can be very process driven because you look at your metrics, right? So you already said that in your first gig, there was 50 bookings a day with an 80% success rate. Now I know based on information you've shared that you had a higher than 80% show up rate, right? So instantly that says to
92%
me, was that?
92% on average.
I was gonna say it was I knew there was a nine there, but I again give you the opportunity of sharing that. That is phenomenal, right? And people listening to this should be thinking, okay, how does somebody do that? Because I'm sitting in a sales role right now. And I'm getting marketing leads thrown at me, and I know there might be marketing qualified leads, and I've got to convert them into sales qualified leads and go through the process. But what is it you have done, or what is it that you now think through when you're doing the RevOps work now to help somebody get to a point where they're discovering and qualifying their customers better to the point where they have a high level of confidence that when we do set an appointment with a prospective customer, that there's a higher than 80% or 50% probability that they're going to turn up? Because I know in the space that I work, in business to business sales, a lot of the time customers don't turn up. They just don't turn up. Right.
We
So
have one to
they
talk
say, yeah,
to
we're
as
interested, but no. And
Yep.
it's a real challenge. So looking back and even with the agency, was there anything specific that you did that enabled you to enjoy a 92% show up rate? Because that's phenomenal in any industry.
I've been able to carry it forward since then. Like, I very rarely get someone not show up, and if someone doesn't show up, it's generally like they'll message me or email me and say something's come up. And I credit a lot of it to a book I read early on in that first sales gig called Pitch Anything by Oren Claff. And he's got another book out now called Flip the Script, which is also really good. But Oren's mindset around sales, I think, is one of the best I've come across in my time, in that it's quite scientific, which obviously kind of ticks the boxes for my brain and how my brain works. It's also coming from the place of like you being the prize, which it's not, I put a post up about it the other day, and it's against of like, oh well, you tell me why I should work with you, type thing. But knowing that your business delivers a tangible solution, there's more customers out there than there are for you. If they've got a problem, they're coming to you for a solution. And that's the sort of mindset that I've taken. Again, not in an arrogant way, but knowing that I'm not there to sell the person or get them to do what I want them to do. I'm there to help them find what they want. So Oren talks about the three stages of the mind that you need to move your, whether it's a pitch or a conversation, whatever you're trying to get someone to do, whether it's book a meeting or close a deal. The initial brain that you're gonna encounter is what he calls the croc brain. I don't know if that is a scientific term, I'm not a neurologist, but it might be. But the croc brain's like the primitive brain, and we all know or have experienced that when we've been either pitched to or sold to. Like, you walk into a shopping center or a clothes store, for example. Someone walks up to you like, "Can I help you with anything?" Before anything comes out, before you think at all, it's like, "No, thanks, I'm all good. I'm just looking."
That's it.
So
That's it.
your fight or flight kicks in before you even rationally think about what they've said. And you're like, I, and a lot of the time you do need help. And you're like, I do need help, when you actually start to think. So when you make calls, especially going outbound, whether it's outbound cold, or I'd still consider low intent lead gen cold because they don't want a call, they haven't requested a call. But even if it's high intent, I always start off with a subtle skeptical tone because I know that the first brain that I'm going to encounter is the croc brain. They're going to try and assess, like, am I a threat? Am I going to try and, pull money out of their pocket, scam them, this, that, or the other? Or am I like a good guy type thing? Am I willing to listen to them? So all the way, rather than going like, oh, hey, Darren, how's your day going? This is Sam from so-and-so or Sam from Shapers. I always start off with a low skeptical tone, like, oh, hi, is that Darren? Yeah, this is Darren. And then it makes you skeptical as well. And then,
Is this?
because now we're on the same wavelength, we're on the same level, because it's like, I'm not here to pitch you or be hypey or anything. And if it's cold, it's like, oh, hey, Darren, this is Sam from Shapers OS or et cetera, et cetera. Whatever it is. And then I'll lead in with like the reason for my call. Whether it's back in those days when it was ebook downloads, you recently downloaded our 108 step guide to blah, blah, blah. And then I'd be looking at finding like if it was something serious they were looking to solve. So I would jump pretty quickly into like, you downloaded our 108 step guide to generating more leads for your business. That wasn't what it was called, but just to as an easy name, was generating more leads for your business something you were seriously looking at the moment? Something along those lines would be sort of my intro. And then they're like, yeah, they're still a little bit skeptical. And then I would go with like, okay, well, and lead out with some questions and stuff like that. And set the frame in terms of time. So like, okay, well, this is just a really quick call, so on and so forth. So I'm trying to set all these frames, which Oren talks about as frame control, early on to establish that one, I'm not a threat, but I can be of value and that I'm worth listening to. Because then I can shift them into what Oren calls the midbrain, which is where there's their emotions are triggered and they're going to be more receptive to what you're saying. And eventually you get them to the neocortex, which is like the decision-making thinking brain. So when I'm booking calls, I'm always moving through these stages and I'm listening for the tonality of the person to know, are they still skeptical or are they still like sussing me out? If they are, I'm not going to raise my tone. I'm not going to be excitable or anything like that. I'm not going to try and ask them for anything at that point. If I've got them out of that, I'll try and I can hear their tone starting to lift. I'll match that and start to extract more emotional based information, like what's it costing you, consequence questions, et cetera. So that sort of frame of thinking really helped me early on, where I wasn't trying to get someone to book. I was just trying to navigate the call until it made sense to get the booking. So I never went in with the intention to book. I went in with the intention to help move them through the processes, see if I can. And then if there was an opportunity, that's when I'll book them.
And most of the calls you made, was it on the back of they had downloaded something? So there was some form of interaction with the organization before they heard from you, or was there sometimes when it was just pure cold?
In that first job, it was all ebook downloads. In PT world, it was pure cold. When I was in the PT space, I would literally walk across to I worked at the Anytime Fitness in Water Gardens, and I'd walk across to the Water Gardens shopping center, and I'd walk around the supermarkets and just try to start up conversations with people to see if they'd come over to the gym. So I've done a bit of it all. But since then, I haven't done since that second gig, I haven't done much pure cold outbound in terms of calling, just because I found that it's kind of a bit of a waste of time compared to other methodologies. Unless I have a really targeted prospect that I just want to get a hold of, which was few and far between. But when it was the high intent lead gen, they still came in with intent, but I was still, even though they came in registering interest in the product or service, I still wouldn't jump in with that sort of high excited tone. I'd still jump in skeptically because they're still going to have that their walls up as to whether you're a threat or whether you're a friend.
It's fascinating, and I love to explore the psychology of this, because even when you look at platforms like LinkedIn, I'm sure you get this. I get LinkedIn requests every day, And sometimes the LinkedIn request with the connection request comes a pitch.
Yep.
Sometimes there'll just be a connection request and I'll look at their background, look at what they do. And I'm getting, for example, a lot of podcast promoters coming from Bangladesh and India and
Yep.
Uzbekistan. And I look at them and think, well, I know what's going to happen, but it's almost like an experiment because I want to know what's their thinking, what's their next step in their process, what am I going to be expecting next? So I'll accept it. And then pretty much most of them, not all, but most, will then follow up almost instantaneously with a pitch.
Yeah, pitch that.
And it's like, really? You guys got no idea about the psychology of anything around selling. So
Yeah.
when you were doing your stuff, and you talked about the three brains, the croc brain or the reptilian brain, the fight, flight, freeze, the midbrain, which invokes a level of emotion, but also the neocortex or the frontal cortex, which is that decision-making brain.
Yeah.
If we think about this, and you made mention of a really important thing, and I think everybody in sales, if they don't recognize this and spend time really thinking about this, then we need to. Your customers don't want your product. They're not interested in your product. They're just not. What they're interested in is, do I have a problem that needs to be solved? And do I have a problem that wants to be solved? So as a salesperson, I would just want to delve into the psychology of this because I think you've explained this, but I just want to get confirmation that I'm on the right track here. I have a belief that this thing in here, this is my AirPods cover, right? This is the best product on the marketplace. It's never been seen before. This is fantastic, right? Now, we have to decide as a salesperson as to who qualifies for this. So talk me through the psychology of that because I think this is what you do and have done intuitively rather than respectfully following a process. Would that be fair? Because you've said before that, hey, I'm not here to convince you. I will choose as to whether I will end up booking you based on whether I think you qualify and you're ready for a booking.
And it comes from that prize framing mindset. And again, it's not coming from a place of arrogance. It's coming from a place of service because I'm not going to book you through if we can't help you. Because I'm doing us a disservice is in the company by wasting the next person's time or my time. But I'm also doing you a disservice as the prospect by wasting your time and potentially leading you down the garden trail that we can't actually help you with. So the frame that I'm always coming from is that qualification objective of can like as simple as can we actually help this person? And sometimes that's not always 100% attainable on the first call. Like some prospects will say all the right things, you book them through, and then it turns out on the next call you find out they're not necessarily a right fit. But that's where understanding your ICP, the problems you really solve, who your best customer is. And in the early days of obviously launching a business, it's not always that easy to uncover. But as the business matures, like something a lot of my clients, for example, just use them as a case study, probably 60-70% of them are PTs. Like in the online space, they've got influence and they drive a decent amount of revenue, whether it's they're sort of like again in that sort of 750, you've got one on track for a couple mil this year. So really well for the fitness space, like in the PT space, especially for solopreneurs with small teams. And the thing that a lot of them get wrong early on is like, well, I just help people lose weight. And it's like, well, there's a lot of solutions that help people lose weight. Who do you specifically help? Like, what's your avatar? What's the niche? Why are they in the situation to need to lose the weight? So I think when you're qualifying prospects, it's not about like, just use the weight loss thing for the easy example. Oh, he's overweight. He's got weight to lose. Sweet, he qualifies. It's too surface level. It's not really thinking through his specific problems. So then you got to look at, okay, well, why has he got weight to lose? Is it a thyroid problem? Is it mental health issues? Is it I don't know, something like does he have PTSD from something in his life or something? So a lot of these things that underlie that will dictate whether you can actually help that person or not. Because if it's someone with a thyroid issue, for example, and you're not qualified to work with someone with a thyroid issue, but you haven't qualified that down, you're going to either book them through and waste your time, or you're going to sell them and not be able to help them, and then they're going to get no results, complain about you, etc. So I think it's really understanding the problems, and that sort of ties into marketing on the front end as well. And that's one of my gripe with a lot of marketers is they just want to sell the click, and they'll use a lot of clickbaity shit just to get people into the next step, which I get the line of thinking, but you want to get the right people in. And if you don't know them and you don't know those underlying issues, how can you get the right people in?
100%. And I'm going to use a word ethics in this, right? And when people think about sales and in some degree marketing, and then they throw the word ethics in there, it's almost like separate,
Yes.
right? But I come from a perspective of whatever we do, whether that's marketing a product, marketing a service, helping somebody, coaching somebody, mentoring somebody, selling something to somebody, it has to be done ethically and it has to be done with impeccable integrity. Because it is coming from a servant's heart. Because if I can't help you with a solution to a problem that A, you've identified you have, B, you've identified that you want and need to solve that problem, then I'm not operating with integrity or ethics. It just has to be. Now, a lot of people think about ethics and sales and I think, well, that doesn't go together because you don't understand, Darren. I'm under so much pressure to hit my sales target. I have to literally throw as much mud up against the wall as I possibly can, hoping that some of it's going to stick. So when I see a live prospect, I'm going to do everything in my power to try and close them.
Yeah, and that sort of ties into what we were chatting about just before around the incentives, right? When if I and Graham talks extensively about this, like if I'm incentivized to, because if I, at the end of the day, if I have to choose between putting food on my table and feeding my family and maybe bending the truth a little bit to get someone to buy something, most people are probably gonna prioritize their own family safety for that. So when the incentive structures are set up in a way that not only enables that behavior but promotes that behavior, it's no wonder that ethics kind of gets thrown out the window because there's very few what's the word like no one's playing Jesus. Like everyone, at the end of the day, for the most part, everyone's out for themselves. Sure, we collaborate together and we work together, but we do it for the betterment of each other and ourselves. And if I'm in that spot where you got to choose between feeding your kids or pushing a sale through because I need to push it through because I need commission this month, then that person's probably gonna make that push through. And that's where I think the ethics kind of slides out the door, and it's not necessarily the seller's fault. Yes, they can obviously, and I've been in that spot before, in that like in that second phase at winning international when the second team came in, and we were, as I said, we had to work with what we had. And I sold a couple of people that I probably shouldn't have sold. And I remember the feeling of like that guilt and like,
Do you feel dirty, Sam?
and you're just like, I don't feel good about this. And then that plants the seeds for me to leave. And then I left. So from a company perspective, it's negative, but from the salesperson's perspective, it obviously, you got to make hay, or make use of what you've got, but you also want to align yourself with a company that does have the right things in place.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic because, and I think organizations are trying to grapple with what is the best way to provide incentives to salespeople or revenue generating people and sometimes marketing people and how do we've got to give an incentive and most of the time they think, well, the monetary incentive is the one that's going to be the biggest motivator. Without really delving into the fact that money is not necessarily the number one motivator for most salespeople and most marketers. It's other stuff. But how do we do it? And I'm not sure there's an organization that's got it right yet in terms of creating that balance between we are an ethical organization that if we don't, and I had this conversation yesterday with a group because we were talking about the finite thinking that Simon Sinek talks about versus the infinite thinking in terms of, sales targets and having to achieve certain objectives by a certain time frame. We have all this implied pressure placed upon us that forces us to take certain actions because of the rewards we're either going to receive when we get the reward or we get the outcome, or the punishment we're going to experience if we don't. And so as we put the focus on, well, Sam, you have to have X amount done by this date, or otherwise you are considered to be a failure, is it any wonder we have behaviors driven in the direction of self-servitude versus serving the greater good? I don't know that there's a perfect metric out there or way of incentivizing people. I know companies are starting to think, well, from a sales team point of view, we're going to remove individual KPIs and individual sales targets, and we're going to now have everybody linked to a group target, which means everybody gets measured based on the contribution they make to the team. But see, there's always a counter argument to that is that, okay, if there's 10 people, Sam is the number one salesperson, he's doing all the work. Sally over there is the worst salesperson, but she gets recognized and paid exactly the same as Sam. How is that fair? So
Yeah,
there's
and then
arguments
Sam's
either
going to
way.
go somewhere else that pays better.
Correct. So I don't know that there's a perfect mechanism to do this. But from a psychology point of view, we have to, as salespeople, get better at understanding that it's not about us pushing onto a client a product or a service. It is about, can I actually help this person, this business, solve a problem that they have? And if I do that, then I will be fairly compensated for that.
And that was part of the one of the sort of taglines that I use for my work is building better buying experiences. Because not only does it reflect better on the company, but it serves the company better for the long term, as you said, in terms of rather being short-sighted, thinking long term, in terms of less client churn, less team churn. You don't have people feeling guilty about what they're selling, et cetera, and then being, oh, I need to leave. This sucks. I can't do this anymore. All clients going and bad mouthing you because you're not, delivering, or you've oversold and under-delivered. So there's, as you said, there's not. I don't think I've seen a perfect model just yet to remove those incentive structures. A lot of it does come onto the salesperson. The closest I think would be Chris Walker's at Refine Labs, and I in that commission only role that I had for 2.5-ish years post winning international. It was commission only, but I had no KPIs. I didn't have the CEO or the founder of the company wasn't like, you need to do this many pitches, this many calls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was just like, mate, if you want to eat, if you want to get paid, go make sales. So
Right.
I was like, okay, that's enough incentive for me to work. And obviously I want to be successful as well. But without that, I found without that pressure of like monthly KPI targets, I need to hit this, et cetera, I could progress deals at the speed at which the deal was needing to be progressed. And because there was enough qualified pipeline coming through, similar to the situation in that 3 month stint at winning that I had when I was by myself, I was able to be choosy with the prospects coming through, so that one, I wasn't pressuring them to, you need to sign today, otherwise, you're going to lose this deal or whatever. I could progress them through at the state at which they needed to progress because I had enough pipeline coming through that I knew I was going to hit more than enough. Like at that in that commission only role, I was on average, sort of raking in about 60K a month in commissions, had a few 100K months in there as well. And it was all like that was sort of my golden era from a sales perspective. But it was all commission only and all ease of flow because the marketing synergized with the sales, which synergized with the CS. And the whole system worked. And what Chris Walker's done in Refine Labs, I think, is probably the closest where sales don't get commissions, they get high salaries. So I think from what he said, they like he pays his top sellers 200K odd base salaries. But what they do, they focus on the marketing end first to understand, okay, well, how much qualified pipeline are we actually producing? And their definition of qualified pipeline is pipeline or from a particular source, whether it's website driven or paid ads driven, whatever the source is. What stage of the sales cycle does it need to get to traditionally convert at 25% or higher? Once it reaches there, it's measured a pipeline. Then they work out how much pipeline they're actually producing, like real pipeline that has a good chance of converting. And then they bring a salesperson in to accommodate for the amount of volume they've got coming through. So I think it's almost a company restructure thought process of like, rather than we bring salespeople in to grow revenue because we're just going to flood them with stuff, it's like, well, we bring the qualified prospects in. And then once we, say a salesperson can handle 10 meetings a week, once we're getting 15 meetings, we bring another one in. And then we rotate that across, because then it obviously ties to retention and stuff on the back end.
Nice. So just on that, talk to me, because I know you've run some, and I've seen a couple of your workshops where you've taken, I guess, explaining that kind of model where an organization may achieve a level of success. So they've got a lot of sales coming in, and they think, oh, we have to expand. We've got to expand our sales team. We've got to expand our marketing team. So they have all these other fixed costs that gets allocated to the business, but often it means that there's a dilution of either quality of the leads that are coming in, or the process by which they process those leads that ends up adding more cost to the bottom line of the business and eating away profitability. So what's your process, or what's your thinking around that? Because I know there's people listening to this, and there's organizations all the time and looking to expand. How do they do it in a managed way so that we can maintain, I guess, the profitability, but also the quality of the service that we provide? Because the other thing people have to realize is, particularly in a B2C space, like if you're working with PTs and naturopaths and things like that, I'm sure they're looking for the lifetime value potential of their clients, not trying to just bring in more and more clients, right? Because you can, if you have somebody who's really engaged with you and the service you provide, and you're providing over the odds from what they're paying for that, there's a high probability that A, they're going to stay, and A, they're going to, and B, they're going to refer others to you. So the sale, I believe, actually starts after the sale is made, not it's not when the sale is made, right? So once you've made a sale, now the work starts. So what's your thoughts process? And I know you've done a bit of work on this in relation to, I mean, companies expanding too quickly and some of the pitfalls, I guess, to be aware of.
Yeah, and I've had a few under NDA, so a couple of companies that I've worked with that are a couple have been ASX listed, some in the fintech and finance space as well, that I've picked up through referrals of clients that I've currently worked with and referred me on, et cetera. And a lot of the time, the issue is very much the same in that they're utilizing a reverse headcount model, which was made famous by Salesforce with their predictable revenue approach, which for them at the time obviously worked really well, and still works really well because the CRM space when Salesforce entered it was pretty new. Like they were pretty much the first into that space to really do it well. So when they were bringing this new solution to market that was saving businesses time, helping them consolidate data, make better decisions, et cetera, like that's a really compelling offer if you've never seen anything like it. So their reverse headcount model of like, we just need to get our message and our product out to more people made sense because the product almost sold itself. But now they're sitting as the category leader in the CRM space, arguably like HubSpot being number two. They're still able to sort of run that model because like you get a call from someone that's like, oh, hey, Darren, this is Sam from Salesforce. You're like, oh, I know Salesforce. Everyone already knows it. But you try and take that model, unless you have something that is really unique, really disrupting, et cetera, which 90% of companies, probably most companies, don't have. They're either entering a category that's already established and putting a different spin on it, like whatever the approach is, you're already competing with category leaders to try and drive that attention away. And when you try and drive that through reverse headcount modeling, you're going to get less and less efficient because, as we were talking about before, and for the viewers, they can't kind of see me doing this with my hands, but you're going to move further and further down that buyer's pyramid to colder and colder audiences that are less and less problem aware. So if you just keep increasing the size, it's just going to keep diminishing in return. And that's what I see a lot of the companies go through these issues when they bulk hire sales and they just flood with marketing. Again, it's similar to like, oh, well, we spent a million, or we spent 100 grand and made a million. If we spend a million, we'll make 10 million in marketing. But because that marketplace or the TAM gets more and more diluted as they push more budget into it, it's just going to bring in prospects that are less problem aware, less sophisticated, which means longer sales cycles, more work for sales, more unqualified prospects to sift through, et cetera. So the whole efficiency of the mechanism just gets worse and worse and worse because they're just trying to grow at all costs, which then chews away at their margins because time is the most expensive resource to scale through. Naval Ravikant talks about this. Like, if you're gonna try and scale through time, you're basically paying for more salaries, obviously. So if you're scaling through sales teams, whether it's 70 to 100K base is probably the average now for a sales rep. You're adding, let's just say 100 for round numbers, 100K base every time you try and scale out, plus extra additional marketing spend to try and feed that person enough work so that they can be profitable for the business. So every rep that you add in headcount gets less and less efficient because you're just saturating a market with an inefficient message. So how to fix that is similar to, again, I won't take credit for this because it's what Chris Walker does, but driving through what he calls hero pipeline, like identifying the stages. So if you have, for example, low intent lead gen, Chris Walker did a study across, I think it was 200 companies or something like that, where from lead, like the time someone enters their details and downloads something, to close percentage was 0.2 or something like that. So for every 1,000 leads you drive, two were actually turning into revenue. Whereas when you say have someone that goes through and puts a request on your website, like whether it's a demo request or speak to sales request, et cetera, the conversion rate is obviously significantly higher, like 30, 40 plus percent. But then most companies go and optimize for the low intent lead gen model because it's easiest to track. They go, okay, well, if we drove 10,000 leads, and that serviced a team of maybe not 10,000, 1,000 leads serviced a team of 10 sales reps, for example. If we just double that, then we're going to double our revenue. Why not? But
Logically, it makes sense.
logically, it makes sense. But in reality, markets aren't fractal in the sense that, for example, a virus is fractal. Like if you put 100 people in a room and one's got a cold, and you lock them all in there for a couple of days, that everyone's going to get a cold after a while. But you lock people in a room and one's got an interest in, let's say, CRMs, for example, he could spend 5 days in there walking around and he might have another couple of mates that are interested in CRMs. It doesn't mean that everyone in that room's going to get interested just because they're around people that are interested. So it's quadratic in that the more you expand, it tapers in efficiency as you go. Not sure if that answers the question, but.
No, that's cool. So the answer to the question is, don't be too bold to expand before. Well, don't expand thinking that the growth and investment in the additional people is going to necessarily result directly in more revenue and more profitability, because probably it's going to be the reverse.
And you need to, like, as you scale out, you need to develop maturity in your campaigns. One of the reasons why, one, I was able to earn so well, but we took that initial business with Jay from sub, or we'll just round it to 1 million, like 1 million in annual revenue to 10 million in annual revenue in 2.5 years, was because we matured the programs where rather than bring another salesperson, it was just like, oh, well, Sam can handle this volume because we're just improving the quality. So we didn't bother trying to hire additional salespeople because I could handle the volume, the quality that was coming in, and it was efficient and effective for the business. So when you break it down into different pipeline sources, such as website, partnerships, trade shows, low intent lead gen, et cetera. And I'm not saying don't do any low intent lead gen, even though it's I lean against it. But if you are going to do it, understand how efficient is this pipeline source. So if we say we have a six-stage sales process, what stage does that a prospect need to reach to actually hit that 25% or higher conversion point? A lot of time for low intent lead gen, it's not until like stage four or five, like late stage sales process. So it's a very heavy sales-driven methodology to get that to work. Whereas website, it's like stage one, two. So it's very marketing led. So from an efficiency perspective, rather than trying to scale through time, let's just make our marketing more efficient so that we bring educated prospects in. Sure, there's going to be a mix and there's not one campaign that's going to rule them all. But if you can get that sort of holistic mix of omnipresence approaches from a marketing perspective, where you're educating the people that need to be educated, and then but you have those lead gen approaches or those sales approaches to move the people through that want to be moved through, then you can scale based on how much actual qualified pipeline are we producing. Are we only producing 10 opportunities a month? We probably don't need a salesperson. The founder should be taking those sales. If the founder, if you're getting 20 opportunities per month, okay, now we need to bring a salesperson in, knowing that they're probably going to perform a bit worse than the founder, because most of the time founders will outperform sellers, because they obviously know the product and are passionate about it. So we know that there's going to be a slight drop off in conversion, but we're going to feed them enough qualified pipeline that they're going to hold our revenue or continue to expand revenue. And then if they want to supplement that with outbound work, et cetera, great. But we know that benchmark minimum targets are going to be hit as long as they continue following the process, because we've proven the process.
It's as you're talking, thinking about expansion, it reminds me of, I'm not sure who said it, but there was, I think it was the chairman or the owner or founder of Chick-fil-A, the UK chicken restaurant chain, who they expanded a lot, but often he would have a lot of pressure from within his organization to keep expanding. And he turned around and he said, no, our customers will tell us when it's time to expand because of their loyalty. So they'll demand based on wanting our product and our service that we need to invest in more stores, for example, right? So, and I think that's a great way to kind of tie this all together, and that your customers will demand that you actually expand, that you need to bring on more marketing or more salespeople to cater for the demand that's being created.
And I learned this, funnily enough, one of my first. So the first job I ever had was at the Mason Ranges Freight, like I told you, and then I got a job at Macca's, and was normal crew at the Sunbury store. And then I, because I lived in Gisborne, when the Gisborne store was opening, I moved to the Gisborne store, and helped open and launch that store. And within like 6 weeks of that being open, I was promoted to management in the store. So basically running the shifts and obviously running teams, et cetera. Understanding the cash flow of the business. So I learned a lot of skills at a really early age from, because Macca's, especially considering I went into personal training and stuff after that, their product is not the best. We'll say that without ragging on them too much. But from a systems and operations perspective, like I haven't seen a company that operates better. And what we were always taught, well, not necessarily taught, but asked to do was do more with less, because they want to obviously hold certain margins, they want to hold profitability. It's not just a matter of, oh, we're getting busy, let's just stick six people in the kitchen so we can keep up with it. It's okay, well, we're busy, how do we utilize the resources that we have to maintain our margins and keep the whole store synergizing together? Do we pull someone out of drive-through to go in the kitchen to help supplement that? Do we cross-train people so that we have multi-skilled people across different departments so that we can leverage that if we do hit those busier periods so that we're not wasting cash? And that was something that was really drilled into us at management level, because even from the food perspective, like they hated wasting food. So we always had strategies and things in place to minimize food wastage. We had strategies to minimize salary wastage, as in like just putting people on for the sake of it. And that mindset, I think, has prevailed with me through my sales career and really helped that, because I understood from the Macca's perspective the synergy between each department in the store. And then going forward, I can see the synergy between marketing, sales, not just marketing, sales, and CS, but even finance as well. Like, because it makes finance job harder. And then finance don't actually understand sales. So they're just like, oh, well, our sales team sucks. Let's cut a few headcounts. Cost a few people their jobs. And that, obviously we've seen the tech space do that a lot, and it a lot of it's unjustified. Some of it is, but most of it's just because they modeled wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the clear message here, if there's one message to leave people listening to this, Sam, in terms of your approach, because it's been a fantastic conversation and we've talked about a lot of different elements of the, I guess, the sales cycle, but organizations. If there was one, if a person listening to this is a founder, entrepreneur, or even a sales leader trying to trying to just make their way or improve the way they do things, if there's one key message you can leave with them in relation to the way they go about their business, whether it be better collaboration or what have you, what would that be?
Build better buying experiences, not only for the customer. Make sure that it's customer centric and that they're actually learning and enjoying the process that they're going through from a sales perspective. They don't need to be like ecstatic over the moon about it, but if they're getting value along the process at each stage of the process, then they're going to have a more enjoyable time, and we can influence, even though we're not telling them and forcing them through, we can influence them to buy from us. But it also, from a internal company perspective, makes it a lot more enjoyable from a salesperson's perspective to know that, hey, I'm not pressured to sell everyone. If I don't feel like we can help this person, I don't need to push them through just to hit numbers. So if people can focus more on, or companies can focus more on just building better buying experiences for both parties, I think the world would be a better place.
And we'll leave it with this, your sales numbers will go through the roof. Just
And
saying.
that as well, yeah. It sounds counterintuitive, but you actually make more money and more revenue when you do it that way versus forcing people through.
Is so true. And it's done ethically because I'm here to serve.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
everyone enjoys it.
Absolutely. Sam, absolute pleasure having you on the show. For people who want to, first of all, connect with you, but also know a little bit more about what you do and whether you might be able to be in a position to possibly help them with any issues they might have around RevOps, where's the best place for them to connect with you, my friend?
Probably LinkedIn is the primary channel that I'm using at the moment. If they want to check out that workshop you mentioned, I do have a link in my bio there for them to go check it out. And I do need to do better with my own content across my omnipresence. So keep an eye out for more expansion, but LinkedIn for now.
And as I said earlier in the show, if you're not connected with Sam right now, please do so, or at least follow him because, mate, you are a prolific content creator. It's like every day you got something in. But the thing I like about what you put out there is it's thought-provoking and it's very measured, but it's very structured, which is valuable. So keep it up, my friend.
Thank you. I try my best. And likewise, if I'm sure everyone listening to this already follows you, but I get a lot of value out of your content as well and these podcasts.
Awesome. Mate, thanks again for being on the podcast and enjoy the rest of your Friday.
Thanks, Darren. You too.
Cheers, mate. Thank you for listening to the Exceptional Sales Leader podcast. I trust the information in this episode has been helpful in your journey towards becoming exceptional. And remember, please take the time to rate the show, subscribe to the show so other people can find it. But also, if I can help you, jump on my calendar, go to leadwithdarren.com, and let's have a conversation about how I can help you along your journey to being exceptional.